Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, January 2025, and our friends, Trito Parsi, Ambassador Chasterman, are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be with you.
Ambassador, let's start with what has happened with Steve Witkoff and his latest talks with Hamas. He said that they're not there. They're not getting to any sort of agreement with Hamas. What is the argument on the part of the United States that it's so difficult to understand the position of Hamas?
Well, you have to begin by realizing this isn't an effort to negotiate a lasting peace. This is an effort to impose terms on Hamas, terms of surrender. And I gather that what happened in Doha was that Hamas had the impertinence to ask for food for the Palestinian population in Gaza, and medicine and other relief. But of course, the entire Israeli strategy, with which the United States is entirely complicit, is to starve the Palestinians out of Gaza and make sure that they don't have any medical care. And so those who are wounded die. Those who are hungry also die. And we're beginning to see now quite a wave of deaths, particularly of children, from malnutrition, adults as well. This is merely the beginning. We're going to see a lot more of it. And I note that the Israelis are doing their usual falsification of the facts, claiming that there is no hunger in Gaza. This is all Hamas propaganda, and that they are protecting the populace from Hamas, which otherwise would steal all the food that would be sent into Gaza. I mean, this is all complete nonsense, but it is, and it is increasingly incredible to people around the world. Israel is now well known for fabricating facts, lying, denying the truth, and this is a case of it. So I think Hamas was perfectly correct to ask for food supplies for the people in Gaza. But apparently this was not acceptable to the Israelis, who walked out. And Steve Witkoff, who is basically in bed with the Israelis, also walked out.
Trito, before going to your comment, here is what Donald Trump said moments ago about Hamas.
Yeah, Gaza, they pulled out of Gaza. They pulled out in terms of negotiating. It was too bad. Hamas didn't really want to make a deal. I think they want to die, and it's very, very bad. And it got to be to a point where you're going to have to finish the job. They really, they asked for things. Don't forget, we got a lot of hostages out. So now we're down to the final hostages, and they know what happens after you get the final hostages. And basically, because of that, they really didn't want to make a deal. I saw that. So they pulled out, and they're
going
to have to fight, and they're
going
to have to get rid of it.
Go ahead, Trito. What he's asking, it seems that some sort of surrender, as Ambassador Chas Freeman was talking about, or you're going to die or surrender.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that from the very beginning, that the only deal the Israelis ever would strike is one that is some sort of a complete capitulation, and that allows the Israelis to continue the war. The Israelis are not going to accept anything that doesn't allow them to continue to bombard Gaza. And this has been a key sticking point at the end of the day. Every deal that has been considered when it comes to the final phase, which is there's an actual permanent truce, the Israelis never accept, and they're very explicit about that. The Trump administration's posture is increasingly becoming that of the Biden administration, which is that they're essentially putting forward Israeli talking points and immediately blaming Hamas, even though in many cases it's very clear that there was never an honest negotiation, or that actually even when the Hamas agreed, the Israelis pulled out, yet Hamas gets the blame. At the end of the day, I think this is largely because this is not important to Trump. He is relegating these issues, the decision-making, to other elements inside of his administration that are much closer to the Israelis, have an ideological commitment to Zionism and to the Israeli state, and letting them drive the train on this one. And as long as it doesn't explode into something that is of larger implication for the United States, then Trump is fine with it. And it certainly keeps a lot of his pro-Israeli donors, such as Miriam Adelson, quite happy. I think this is also part of the reason why we've seen the attacks against the universities and the students. This is largely driven by those elements. And for Trump, this isn't important. So it's a rather inexpensive giveaway to keep some of his donors happy. And on other issues, sometimes he challenges them if those issues are important to him. Iran was early on, and clearly he caved on that as well at the end of the day.
I think that's correct. He's made a decision to back his donors in this case, and not to question them, and not to allow any distance to develop between him and them. And the pattern that Frida just explained is one that's been longstanding. That is, the United States negotiates with Israel about what to do about the Palestinians. It doesn't negotiate with the Palestinians about their future. It presents an Israeli position, or one that has been crafted in compromises between the United States and Israel. Second point that I would make is, if you are paying any attention at all to the news, you see that Israel's now come forward with a plan for Gaza. It's put forward its own version of the Riviera on the Mediterranean, second Riviera plan that Trump proposed. And it doesn't include any Palestinian presence at all in Gaza. Somehow the Palestinians are gone, dead or departed. And at the same time, Israel has also presented a resolution to annex the entire West Bank, totally getting rid of the Oslo Accords framework. The interesting thing is that Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, in the middle of all this, appears to recognize that there need to be new elections in the Palestine Liberation Organization. And many people are putting forward the candidacy of Khaled Mishal, who is the former head of Hamas. I met him in Damascus once. I found him a very intelligent and interesting man. You really should interview him if you can get an Arabic interpreter, because his English is not. He may have learned it since I met him, which was quite a while ago. Lots of things are happening and nobody's paying any attention because the Epstein files are sopping up all of the press coverage. That's really quite remarkable.
Trito, we had Emmanuel Macron, for the first time he's talking about recognizing the state of Palestine in his letter to Mahmoud Abbas. When it comes to Emmanuel Macron and you see the history behind what's happening in Ukraine, every other day he changed his mindset on what's going on in Ukraine. When it comes to Gaza, do you think that he's honest? And why does he need to announce it on September?
I think there's a particular backstory here, which is that there was a resolution passed in the UN General Assembly last year that essentially gave full mandate for the UN to help establish a two-state solution. And it was about the implementation of it, not the negotiation of it. It was then translated into a conference that France and Saudi Arabia took on themselves to organize. It was supposed to be held in middle of June, of this past year. Everything was getting ready. Macron was going to recognize Palestine at that conference. He was going to be there. So was MBS of Saudi Arabia. There was a lot of negotiations going on in which the French were also pressing the Brits to recognize Palestine. The Germans were feeling very uncomfortable because they would end up becoming the last large state in Europe that would not be recognizing Palestine. In my personal view, recognition is a bit of a sideshow, because recognition doesn't establish a state. And there were other things that could come through that conference, which essentially was, at the most charitable reading, and I say this because my organization was quite involved with several of the delegations that were participating there, to establish an alternative path, because the only game in town has been Oslo, and Oslo has been dead. Oslo is completely discredited. But there needed to be something else, because otherwise there's nothing, and then there's Oslo, and it just creates paralysis and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want with the full annexation. The Israelis bombed Iran, I think, 4 days before that conference was supposed to start. And as a result, the conference was delayed. It is now going to take place on Monday in New York. But at the ministerial level, rather than at the very high level that it was supposed to be in June. But it's going to prepare the ground for a larger effort at the UN General Assembly in September of this year. And I suspect, and this is just pure speculation on my end, that the French decided to come out already now. And I've spoken to others who are part of the planning here who were taken by surprise, did not expect the French to announce it now. But I suspect it has something to do with the fact that things are getting very tense. And I think the French are also under some form of a pressure from their own population, of course, as well, because everyone is seeing that we will, in the next couple of days, see mass starvation in Gaza. We're already seeing starvation. In the next couple of days, we're going to see deaths in probably more than the hundreds and the thousands. And there is a realization that you are already late. You have not condemned this. You have not prevented this. You have said Israel has a right to defend itself for almost 2 years, and as a result, you're complicit. And I think several states are trying to now quickly shift their rhetorical position on this in order to escape some of the blame that many of them do deserve. And I would say the United Kingdom in particular deserves a tremendous amount of blame for the current situation. And you will see Starmer and others come out with all kinds of statements pretending as if they're against this, whereas in reality, they have played a critical role in enabling this, as of course has the United States, both under Biden and unfortunately under Trump as well.
There's a less charitable interpretation, which is that Macron, having said he would announce this in June, has now pushed it to September. This is fairly typical, as in fact Nima asked. He is a very wobbly character in politics. But there are a couple of interesting points here. There may not be any Palestinians alive in Gaza by September. And, you know, so this is a really ironic delay. And I don't think I agree with you, Trita, that recognition is a purely symbolic act demonstrating support for the two-state solution. It doesn't create a state. That can only happen with Israeli acquiescence, which is never going to be given. This is political posturing on every level, and we'll see whether, in fact, there is a recognition in September, if there's anything left to recognize.
Trita, Starmer was asked in his one of his latest interview was asked about the threats for the United Kingdom. He mentioned Russia, and then it would be Iran. Do you understand why Iran is a threat to the United Kingdom?
Now, what you're seeing here, I think, is the three stages of some sort of a bloc formation. I find it quite laughable that Iran should be considered a threat. That doesn't mean that the Iranians are not doing things in the UK. I'm sure there's been quite a lot of negative engagements by them. There's been a lot of stories in Sweden as well. A threat, however, is a rather ridiculous statement. I think one can say, however, that Iran's support for Russia in Ukraine fundamentally changed European perspectives on Iran. Prior to that, the Israelis were constantly telling the Europeans Iran is a threat, is an existential threat, and the Europeans were kind of nodding along, but certainly did not perceive Iran to be a threat to Europe itself. By having supported Russia and Ukraine, the perceptions have changed. The idea, however, that it actually would form a military threat directly, not in the indirect sense of supporting Russia and Ukraine, but directly, is a bit laughable at this point. We may go down a path, however, in which with the snapback decision at the UN and the perception in Iran that the Europeans and much of NATO actually was deeply involved in the war, in the 12-day war. Israel certainly was not alone. There's no secret about the role the United States played, but accusations that also NATO as a whole, or at least in parts, were involved, may then create a very different scenario down the road, particularly if the Iranians go in the direction of nuclear weapons, in which there will perhaps by then be a much more real sense of threat from Iran, rather than what we're seeing right now, which is a rather exaggerated image. That would, to the best of my knowledge, be the first time since Darius' invasion of Greece that Iran actually would pose a real military threat to Europe, which then tells you there's a dramatic shift in realities. We're not there. I'm just saying that if the mismanagement of this continues, you have a snapback. You have the Iranians. Right now, they're in a scenario in which they believe that there's an extreme likelihood that the Israelis will strike again, and that the Israelis may even do so as early as before end of August, perhaps in conjunction with the snapback decision. And that under those circumstances, Iran cannot afford to allow the Israelis to have any degree of success, because that would then turn Iran into the next Syria or the next Lebanon, a country that Israel strikes with impunity, and it would then also be able to do so without American involvement. That would mean that the Israelis would own the Iranian skies. The Iranians cannot allow for that, which suggests to me that in the next phase of the war, the Iranians will hit the Israelis back extremely hard, very early, in order to dispel any notion that the Israelis can succeed in turning Iran into the next Syria or the next Lebanon. But there is no certainty as to whether the Iranians will succeed or not. There's a lot of different factors, and we can go into that in greater detail. But precisely because there is no certainty, I think it has now created a situation in which the Iranians had not made a decision to go for nuclear weapons before. But at this point, the three legs of their deterrence, the nuclear, the Axis, and the missiles, are the only ones that they have. Two of them are gone, more or less. If in the next war they fail, and despite the success of their missiles in the first war, they nevertheless fail to deter the Israelis, they fail to dispel this notion of being able to dominate Iran militarily, then the only other option they have is to actually dash for a nuclear weapon. And my suspicion is that because they cannot be certain about how the next war will go, they are probably seriously considering weaponization already at this stage. And whatever damage was done to the Iranian nuclear program and all of these assessments that it will take 3 years to build, that's to rebuild that old program. When it comes to building a weapons program, that's a completely different timeline at completely different facilities that may not even have existed until 3 weeks ago. So I think we have... Trump and Israel has created a much more dangerous world with far greater risks, not just for the United States and Israel itself, and of course for the region, but also one in which, in this extension, this long answer I'm giving you, if we mismanage this further and the Iranians build a nuclear weapon and the threat perception from Europe then starts getting mirrored by the Iranians, then that would be the first time since Darius' invasion of Greece in which actually the Iranians could pose a realistic military threat towards Europe.
I think the part of this, frankly, the reason this is laughable, as you say, Trita, is that Britain takes itself far too seriously. The maximum pressure is coming from the United States, not Britain. And I think what has happened is very likely, of course, I don't know what facilities are existent now in Iran. What survived, no one knows really, since the IAEA has been expelled. But my guess is that Iran is going to take the same course as North Korea did under maximum pressure. That the North Korean example demonstrates that if you build an ICBM that can strike the United States with a nuclear warhead, you don't have to worry about being invaded or attacked. Iran excels at building missiles. And I think you're absolutely correct. It has not had a nuclear weapons program per se. It now has every incentive to create one. And on top of that, my guess is that if indeed the enriched uranium survived, as I believe it almost certainly did, the Iranians have every incentive to re- to process it to the 87.5 or 90% weapons grade level, even if they don't have a nuclear weapons program, because that gets them closer to nuclear latency. So I think what we've done between the Israelis and us is create a menace that didn't exist, but I don't think it's a menace to Britain or Europe. I think it's a menace to us. That is not a wise thing to have done.
Trito, I talked with Professor Ted Postol, and he mentioned his assessment shows that Iran, doesn't matter what the United States and Israelis are talking about, Iran has the capability and they can produce at least 10 nuclear bombs if they want to do, if they go in that direction. Do you see that can be recognized by the two governments, that can be considered by the governments in the United States, and I would argue in Israel? Are they really thinking of it?
I would be very surprised if there isn't awareness of this. Now, there's different assessments, of course. I don't think anyone in the U.S. government believes that this issue is closed, that the pathways have been closed. I don't think there's anyone that seriously believes that Iran's motivation, which was more or less non-existent before all of this, the U.S. intelligence assessment was that they had not made a decision to go in that direction. The decision makers were not leaning in that direction or leaning in the direction of changing their position. Now they are. The conversation in Iran has changed dramatically, not just within the elite, but perhaps even more so in the public. And that is not surprising. And this is a significant and remarkable, two very important shifts have happened as a result of this attack when it comes to the public. First of all, there's always been this debate inside of the system, Nizam, whether to talk to the US or not. It has always in the last 25 years, 30 years, happened against the backdrop of a population that by and large supported engagement. This has to a certain extent shifted now. Right. Because the perception is very strongly that Iran was deceived. Some believe the deception started in January. I personally think that's wrong. Others believe that it started a little bit later, perhaps a week before the attack. I find credible evidence for that. And beyond that, Trump himself said that he was engaged in a deception operation. So the belief is that diplomacy was used to deceive the Iranians and lull them into a false sense of security. As a result, there's skepticism against further engagement by the public, not a majority, or I don't know what the numbers, I'm just saying that it has shifted, because it sends the signal that the government has not learned the lesson and is once again falling into a trap of deception. This was not the case in the last 25, 30 years, in which the debate was within the system, but that society by and large was strongly in favor of engagement. That's one. The other one is that the public has by and large been in favor of enrichment, Iran's scientific rights, etc. But I've never seen any credible poll showing a strong support for weaponization. And there's historic roots of that. The Shah pursued the same strategy. He wanted to have enrichment, he wanted to have the capability, but recognized that there were a lot of strategic negatives for Iran to actually building the bomb. The only thing that could shift it was if the security environment changed and Iran was under a completely different type of a threat, which is exactly what the Israelis created on June 13th. And the public has, by and large, shifted them. Basing this largely on conversations and anecdotal evidence, I haven't seen any polls yet, but I would be very curious to see what those polls would be. But just take a poll in Turkey that was done, in which the support for weaponization was very, very low, and only ticked up a little bit in the scenario in which Iran has gotten nuclear weapons. And now you have a scenario in which 59% of the Turkish population, absent any nuclear weapon in Iran, absent any other change beyond the situation we're in right now, believe that Turkey needs to get a nuclear weapon. Turkey was not attacked by two nuclear weapon states. So you can just imagine what the population in Iran likely will be thinking right now. And those are two very important shifts that have happened that were more or less stable for the last 30 or so years.
Those are very good.
And Turkey is part of NATO, Ambassador. Go ahead.
Yes.
But Turkey is pursuing military self-reliance. It has now apparently developed and is preparing to field a hypersonic missile. Initially, one that... is essentially a short-range missile, but there is a variant which has a 1,000-kilometer range, and it's aimed at Israel. The Turks are being driven in a direction quite different from other members of NATO. There's one element here that is, Peter, you didn't mention, which I think is rather important, and that is the question of whether anyone dares contradict the president's statement that the Iranian program was obliterated. The record shows that anybody who questions his often ridiculous judgments about what's happening, is punished. And we now see Tulsi Gabbard essentially prostituting herself in order to curry favor with Trump on the whole Russiagate business. Is there anyone who would dare to tell Trump that he's wrong? You notice that Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, seems to be trying to agree with Trump when he says there was very severe damage done to the program. That makes sense in terms of putting off an Israeli attack. And there, treated as another element, which is the departure of the United States supposedly from Iraq, which means that the airspace in Iraq will be controlled by Iraq, not by the U.S. And that happens in September. So that is why an August attack is in somehow related to a possible deadline for the Israelis. Finally, I think President Pezeshkian, directly affirmed your statement that Iran will hit Israel very, very hard this time. It will not hold back as it did on three previous occasions. It will not engage in performative attacks. They will be real attacks, as they were, in fact, toward the end of the so-called 12-day war. So I think we are in a period over the summer that is pretty dangerous, and particularly because Prime Minister Netanyahu is in ever greater political difficulty, and his response to political difficulty historically has been to start a war or do something further in the ongoing forever war with an enemy.
Trito, when it comes to the main objective of Israeli attack on Iran, I really believe that it was all about regime change. It wasn't about the Iranian nuclear facilities, because they have tried, the United States tried to use bunker buster bombs in Yemen. That was not successful. And how can you imagine that they would somehow believe that they're going to be successful in their operation toward Fordo and other nuclear facilities that are deep underground? But how... If we assume that was the main goal, the regime change, and so what? How can you make sense of a new attack on Iran? What would the objective of that?
So, I wouldn't use the word regime change. I think what they were going, because what regime change usually means is that you change the regime from one thing to another thing. That's what the United States did in Iraq. It goes in, takes out the previous regime, and was very active, of course, in planting a new regime there. What the Israelis are doing is going for regime collapse and decapitation without taking any responsibility for what comes afterwards. In a regime change operation, you need to have troops on the ground to actually, fight it out on the streets and establish a new one. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for decapitating the current regime and then let the chaos fester, hopefully start some sort of a civil war, secessionist movements in Kurdistan, Balochistan, perhaps Azerbaijan, and essentially destroy Iran internally. They will need someone like Reza Pahlavi, who I don't think they have the slightest faith in, but serves a very valuable purpose, which is to give an Iranian face to an attack on Iran. To give the impression that when the Israelis are bombing the Iranians want to get bombed. He was essentially playing the role of an IDF spokesperson on TV, just as much as IDF spokesperson go on air and try to explain away every war crime they're committing in Gaza or in Lebanon, he was going on air saying that the Israelis are not trying to target Iranian civilians, et cetera, et cetera, and essentially playing the role that the IDF usually does. But that's the extent of the utility that he has for them. I don't think they have the slightest belief that he will ever take over the country or even move himself from Maryland. But for the extent of the regime collapse, however, is that it would enable the Israelis to establish that type of air dominance over Iran, that not only would allow them to attack Iran with impunity whenever they wanted, whenever the Iranians are trying to regroup or re-establish their own deterrence, but also to do so without America's involvement, as they have been able to do by and large in Syria and Lebanon. Right now, they cannot do that because whenever they attack, they get attacked back. And in order to defend themselves, the U.S. has to be intimately involved. We just saw the numbers coming out that 14% of U.S.'s THAAD anti-missile batteries were consumed during these 12 years. And it's going to take 3 to 5 years for the United States to replenish them. They want to have a scenario in which they can do this on their own without the U.S. This means creating, decapitating the regime, let the chaos fester, making sure that they're no capacity of posing a threat, and then mowing the lawn, keep on bombing every 6 months, every 2 years, whatever is necessary. Now, what's important to understand of what happened here, though, is that the Israelis were taken by significant surprise by the resilience of the government. They managed to disrupt the command and control for about 12 to 18 hours. But afterwards, the Iranians came back, had full control, replaced all of the military personnel, and then started firing large numbers of missiles with significant success rate at the Israelis' back. And this happened also, incidentally, while the Israelis, I don't know if you saw the tapes that the Israeli Mossad released and leaked to the Washington Post, in which they have perfect Farsi language people calling Iranian generals in the midst of those first 12 hours, because you can hear on the tape saying 2 hours ago, we killed General Salami. So this is within the first 12 hours. And they're telling these generals, we will kill you, we will kill your wife, and we will kill your children. If you do not tape yourself saying that you're leaving the country, you're abandoning this regime, and you send that video to a Telegram address. They made about 20 of these calls, apparently, at a moment in which there was panic and chaos in Iran. And to the best of our knowledge, not a single one of those generals taped any such video. Because if they had, the Israelis would surely have released it, because that was all part of the regime decapitation. And it failed. It caused a tremendous amount of damage on Iran. They took huge hits. A large number of high-level people were killed. But this was no Hezbollah. This was certainly no Assad regime, in which the rot inside was so deep that just a little bit of a shaking of the tree, the whole thing would fall apart. But that then means that the Israelis are going to keep on trying. They're not just going to stop at this point. They're going to keep on trying, but there's several different factors that come into play. The political window that Chas spoke about, but also the logistical military window of how long does it take for them to replenish their arsenals. And can they operate faster than the Iranians? Can they rebuild many of the Mossad assets that they have inside of Iran? Or were they one-time usage things? And as a result, they're not going to be able to pull off that type of a surprise on the Iranians again.
I agree with you, Trita. It's not regime change, it's regime removal. And the pattern, the path to that is similar to the path to the subjugation of Lebanon and Syria. Now, that is the fragmentation of the country, dividing it so it can be ruled and manipulated. This has happened in Lebanon with various factions in Lebanon allying themselves with the Israelis and against others. It happened in Syria in the very long civil war that was set off there with support from some Gulf Arab countries, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Israelis. The Israelis disingenuously claim they were not involved, but they were providing medical support and so forth to various factions in Syria. So the objective in the end is to fragment Iran so that it is at odds with itself. But it is, regime change, frankly, it has a very bad record As you said, Trita, you know, you want to replace one thing with another, but what is the other? And in this case, I don't think they give a fig what the other is. They just want to subjugate and subordinate Iran to their will. Because,
I mean,
why?
No other, I think, is the preference. No other means chaos and a vacuum. At least for a period of time, that is the preference, I think.
You ask yourself why they continue to bomb Syria. And the answer is the whole Israeli state is founded on a deep, deep paranoia about everyone who isn't Israeli. Even American Jews are not trusted by the Israelis. Why? Because they've suffered trauma. The trauma of the Holocaust, which they've made the organizing myth for their country, and the trauma of October 7th, which they've exaggerated incredibly and embroidered. And so they will not be content until they subordinate everyone within range of them. And inasmuch as ranges are constantly lengthening, there's no end to this. They will continue to be belligerent. They will be interested in the surrender rather of others rather than an accommodation with them. And Iran is not going to get off the hook with the Israelis.
When it comes to regime change or regime removal, Trita, we can bring China and Russia into the equation. They're not out of the equation. They know that Iran is so important strategically in terms of the security of both countries. How do you see the way that Iran is trying somehow coordinating everything, each and every step with these two countries?
I have to say, I've not seen strong evidence there is that level of coordination. I think there is a tremendous amount of disappointment and anger in Iran, particularly towards Russia, given the support that Iran gave Russia. I think the Iranians thought that given the fact that the Europeans had not lived up to the JCPOA, they didn't have much to lose by supporting Russia and Ukraine and much to gain. I don't think that's necessarily proven to be true. They are paying a price for it because the Europeans have become, it's not the same E3 that was formed in 2003 with the explicit aim of trying to prevent another war. That's not the same E3 any longer. Then with China, it's a little bit different because the Chinese never signed up for anything. And the Iranians, I don't think, have that expectation with the Chinese. But there's a strategic agreement between Russia and Iran, not one that requires the Russians to step in militarily, but nevertheless give some other degree of support. The fact that the Iranian regime has proven its resilience may also lead to a scenario in which the Russians and the Chinese are a little bit more comfortable, knowing that it's not going to lead to regime collapse. Regime collapse obviously would be very bad for them. Russia would also pay a very heavy price because of the instability that it would cause. But they are all embroiled in their own potential conflicts with the United States right now. And any decision they make is going to be seen through the prism of how that affects their own tensions and potential future confrontation with the United States. Neither of them have ever signed up for sacrificing themselves for Iran, and Iran should have no such expectations.
I think they are a little different. Russia, I believe, will provide technological tech transfer and probably aid in building some kind of self-reliance within Iran. The Chinese are a little more complicated because while they have now demonstrated the efficacy of their aircraft, their export model aircraft, and there are apparently discussions between Iran and China about the purchase of such aircraft. They will sell things, but they're inhibited by the fact that they also want a very good relationship with the Gulf Arabs. Their ideal scenario would be that they sell to both sides, much as the U.S. used to do. And I think they will consider this very carefully. Air defenses are a different matter. I think we're going to see a massive transfer of sale of Chinese air defense equipment to Iran.
Wouldn't that take months, if not years, to fully install and operational?
It can't deal with the August scenario, no.
Yeah.
But it does deal with the longer-term scenario. Mm. And let's not forget that having been put in the position of North Korea under maximum pressure, Iran has its own relationship with North Korea, yeah. which has been helpful in terms of the development of its ballistic missiles and so forth in the past. So I think Iran is going to continue to go down the road of self-sufficiency, and it's going to become more and more formidable, and it's going to try to develop the direct threat, not to Britain, but to the United States, that it needs in order to deter American irresponsibility.
Yeah. Trita, when you look at Iran in the aftermath of the attacks, do you feel that Iran would go deeper to build new facilities to somehow find some sort of new strategies to go against? As Ambassador Chastriman mentioned, Iran is not going to surrender. They're not going to do that. And I don't know why in the West they believe that by putting a lot of pressure, they can achieve that. Your take on that?
No, I don't see them surrendering at all. In fact, the narrative that is forming, of course, is a validation of the skepticism that the hardliners held, particularly Khamenei himself, who believed that if they gave on enrichment, immediately the new issue would be missiles. And if they gave on missiles, the new issue would be kitchen knives. And seeing how the Israelis are bombing Syria, after Syria did everything Israel wanted and bent over backwards, even essentially accepted that Israel is now taking more Syrian territory, and nevertheless, they ended up bombing Syria. I think there is very little belief within the system and within society that capitulation actually leads to safety, actually leads to an end to the conflict. I don't think that belief was never particularly strong, but there were clear elements that thought that there were other ways out. Now, I don't think any one of them believes so. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have to go for a nuclear weapon or other things like that, but the idea that if they give in on enrichment or anything else, that that would actually satisfy the Israelis, there's absolutely no evidence that that is the case. The Syrians don't have a nuclear weapons program or a nuclear program at all. And we have seen how the Israelis, at the weakest moment of the Syrians, took the opportunity of bombing them even further.
There is a great irony here, because according to Araghchi, they were actually very close in Muscat to reaching an agreement. At least that's the impression that Steve Witkoff gave them. And I think in retrospect, they now must assume all of that was part of a deception, although I agree with Trita, the deception probably came on the spur of the moment rather than was not embedded in the talks. But they have absolutely no incentive to believe that the United States will stand by any agreement it makes. They've had the experience of the repudiation of the JCPOA by the very man who's now the president. They've had the experience of being deceived about negotiations being the American priority, when in turn it turned out that supporting the Israelis in their attack on Iran was the American priority. So I think, you know, we're at an impasse. And the sad part of this is, I don't believe, by the way, Trita, that the Israelis can adequately reconstitute their defensive, their multi-layered defense system in time to match the Iranians. And I take the Iranians quite seriously when they claim that they never even drew on the reserves they had stored in deep caverns throughout the country. That they have the wherewithal to really, really injure Israel. And of course, as you know, within Iran, there are those who have been arguing that accepting the so-called ceasefire that Trump came up with was all to the benefit of Israel and not to the benefit of Iran. So I think the next round is going to be pretty awful if there is one.
I agree. There's definitely voices in Iran who believe that the ceasefire was far more to the benefit of Israel than it was to Iran. And news stories that come out and show how low the American arsenal also had turned is further evidence in support of those arguments. Nima John, I'm so sorry. I do have to run. Chaz, as always, tremendously
thank you,
great to see you and honored to be on the show with you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Feeling is mutual. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Ambassador, I don't know if you have if you watch the CEO of one of the drone factories of Iran. And he said he had an interview with Al-Mayadeen. It's on YouTube. You can see it later. But one of the points that he's making during the interview, he said that the United States, together with Israel, they had a plan for 3 days, not beyond that, when they attacked Iran. And because they thought they could achieve something in 3 days, that which wasn't the case. Do you think that was the case somehow?
I don't think it doesn't sound right to me. However, I do believe President Trump saw this as, you know, in and out, quickly, one off, not a path to a forever war. And he was mistaken in that. I mean, the changes that this American attack on Iran helped bring about in the wake of the Israeli attack have basically created a forever war, meaning that there's no end in sight. It's not clear what terms would conceivably end this fight. You know, I think we're down to Israel has created an existential menace to itself, and Iran is not prepared to accept an existential menace to itself, and it has the ability to stand off. It's big enough, tough enough, well enough armed, and self-sufficient enough to stand on its own. Israel is totally dependent on supplies from the United States and elsewhere, and you know, it's also dependent, of course, on the Chinese rare earths that come via the United States, but don't do that anymore. The Chinese have agreed to export rare earths to the United States, but not to military end users. And somehow this has been overlooked in all of the glorification of the president's apparent understanding with the Chinese, which is going to run out in a bit anyway. I think Israel's under exactly the pressure that Frida mentioned to restart the conflict. I don't think it has the ability to do that without suffering huge damage. And I don't know how much more damage it can take. You know, the consequences of the Iranian successful penetration of the Israeli air defenses, missile defenses, have been great, very great. And certainly Israel has been reminded that without the United States, it can't defend itself. That gives the United States a lot of leverage if we chose to use it. There's no sign that this administration wants to use it any more than the Biden administration did.
When it comes to the way that Russia sees Israel and the foreign policy of Russia toward Israel, they were so cautious when it came to Israel and the way that Iran sees Israel, that this sort of difference between Russia and Iran on Israel. But it seems with what has happened, two attacks, the attack on Russian nuclear bombers, then the attack on Iran, the similarities of the attacks. And here is the Israeli foreign minister talking about the situation with Ukraine.
Russian strikes against civilians. We call for a durable and lasting peace which ensures security for Ukraine. Israel is supporting Ukraine and its people. We were the first nation to open a field hospital in Ukraine. We provided generators, food, water, and winter equipment. 2 weeks ago, I instructed my ministry to provide potable drinking water systems to areas in Ukraine that lack clean water after being hit by Russian attacks. It will be done very soon. We send experts to help with PTSD and resilience. We helped Ukrainians injured in the war with the recovery process in Israel. We stand with Ukraine and its people.
Yeah, it seems that the situation between Russia and Israel would change in future. It is not going to remain the same as it was before.
I'm not sure I'd draw that conclusion. I think that is an effort by Israel to achieve a measure of solidarity with Europe, with Western Europe in particular. Of course, in fact, Israel is not in solidarity with Western Europe. It has excellent relations with President Orban, or Prime Minister Orban in Hungary, and it is very much aligned with right-wing forces in Europe against the existing governments. So this is an effort to say, look, we're on your side, Europe, you know what you want, and therefore you have to support us because we're supporting you. And of course, the reason for making that argument is that support for Israel is rapidly disappearing as Israel does the horrible things it is doing. It basically has adopted the entire Nazi agenda, which was applied to the ancestors of the people who settled Israel from Europe, European Jews. So there is starvation, genocide, concentration camps, and now Lebensraum, a search for greater space. So let's annex Syria, let's annex Lebanon. You know, in Lebanon, the Israelis have declared a no-build zone in the south. They've built their own bases. The United States has advocated on their behalf the disarmament of Hezbollah. But the Lebanese army has never been able to defend Lebanon. The only force that ever has defended Lebanon has been Hezbollah. And it represents, you know, I'm not very fond of Hezbollah. It was a militia built in order to defend Lebanese against Israeli occupation, 1982 on. So it was a militia. It grew a political arm that it's pretty fascist, in my opinion. I don't admire its politics. But on the other hand, it's patriotic. It defends its own people. It stands up against the Israelis, whereas other Lebanese, as I mentioned, have either proven unable to stand up to the Israelis, or some of them have actually actively cooperated with the Israelis. And in the situation in Lebanon, let's not forget, Lebanon was created by the French. It was carved out of Syria to be a Christian-dominated part of Syria. But of course, demographic change has happened. Now it is majority Shia. Christians are a relatively small minority. The Alawites, who ran the country for quite a while, are being persecuted, apparently, by the new regime. The Druze, Israelis have tried very hard to separate the Druze from other Syrians, haven't succeeded, but Lebanon is a complex, like Syria, of which it was once part. It is a complex, multi-religious, multi-ethnic society. And what the Israelis are doing really is basically motivated by more by paranoia and a desire to subjugate everyone than by anything else.
Here is, since you mentioned Hezbollah, here is what the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, Tom Brock, said about Hezbollah throwing flowers at Israelis.
And various interjections. We had a Hezbollah that used to throw flowers on the Israelis when they came in the 70s. So the issue of Hezbollah being a particular problem is not just the problem. It's how do we bring stability, security, and transparency.
There was not Hezbollah at the 70s.
Right.
Hezbollah was formed as a result of countering what was happening in the 70s. And at that time, it was not anti-Israeli. They were throwing flowers on the Israelis. You were too young to remember. I remember. We have the same beautiful head, but I'm cycling a little bit ahead of you. So his point is how can we as America help bring calm, ease the tensions on all sides, including Israel, including what is...
I would assume someone to Turkey, the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, should be well informed about the region. And
well, he's Lebanese descent. He's Christian, Christian Lebanese. That means he's anti-Shia. You know, and accusing the Shia in Lebanon of welcoming the Israelis is complete nonsense. The people who did welcome them were the Christians, his own group. And by the way, you know, one of the things we didn't mention in talking about the Palestinian issue and Israeli support in the West, the Israeli actions against Christians, which are nothing new, but have not, they're now being publicized. Israeli attacks on churches, Israeli attacks on Christian worshipers, Christian villages. The Pope has condemned them. This makes a difference. And so anyway, but I think the ambassador is completely mistaken in terms of when Hezbollah was formed and how it was formed. The interesting thing actually in the history of warfare in that part of the world is that it was Shiites in Lebanon who invented suicide bombing. Long before the Palestinians took it up, Palestinians being mostly Sunni, this is, you know, and of course, it isn't even true that suicide bombers in the Middle East outdo others. There are kamikaze pilots from Japan. There is Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka who were ferocious. The Viet Minh, the precursor to the Vietnamese Communist Party, drove the French out of North Vietnam in part by the suicide bombing. There was a lot of suicide bombing resistance to the American occupation in Vietnam. So we have a very distorted view of Lebanon and its history and its politics. And I'm sorry to hear our ambassador to Turkey.
I was somehow surprised that he has the Lebanese origin.
Yes, indeed. And that's why he's been given an informal role in with regard to Lebanon. This administration has no policy process. It has no principles. It has no objectives. It has no strategy. It has no tactics. What it does have is loyalty to the great leader, Donald Trump. And Tom Barrack is well known as a crony of Donald Trump. So anyway, he's got a difficult job, I guess, sitting in Turkey now.
Turkey specifically is so difficult. Ambassador, when it comes to the latest talks, round of talks between Russia and Ukraine, do you see anything substantial coming out of the talks? Because it's all about the prisoners, it's not about some little issues.
It's not about a broad peace. It's about various technical details, exchanging prisoners of war, returning corpses, this kind of thing, not dealing with any fundamental issues. I think there's a deadline that Mr. Trump has given of 50 days. Mr. Putin evidently also gave a deadline of 60 days. The deadlines seem to coincide. And Russia's going to take all the territory it can in that time. And I don't think it's at all interested in talking to Zelensky, given Zelensky's history in those talks. The repudiation of the 2022 April agreement, the repudiation of a meeting with Vladimir Putin, and so forth. And so And by the way, there's nothing that can save Ukraine. There are no weapons that Donald Trump has promised, weapons that don't exist, that are in God knows where. We can't. We are, as Trita mentioned, we exhausted a lot of our defensive missile defense equipment in supporting the Israelis, and we don't produce at a rate that will enable us to supply Ukraine. So Ukraine's problem is manpower. They've run out of Ukrainians to send to the battlefield. And there's nothing the foreigners can do about that. And, you know, assuming we're not willing to send our own troops, which no one is willing to do. And so the talks are useful in that they help deal with specific problems arising from the war, from combat. You also keep the door open to later talks when and if both sides are ready for them. Ukraine is not ready to settle. Russia has put forward its demands. I don't see it abandoning those demands. So what it can't take on the at the negotiating table, it will take at the on the battlefield. And that is what is going on. This is not a good picture because Ukraine is being ground to bits.
How all of a sudden we see protests popping up in Ukraine against Zelensky, against the corruption, by the way. The main objective is the corruption in Ukraine. How do you feel that maybe Europeans, I would say, I don't know if we can say Europeans, United Kingdom together with Germany, or maybe France, they have decided to somehow replace Zelensky?
I don't know that they have. I know that President Trump would like him gone, and he's made that pretty clear. And there is a history of throwing out democratically elected leaders in Ukraine with support from CIA and others, MI6. That may be what is behind some of these demonstrations. Although the problem of corruption is really serious, and many Ukrainians believe that President Zelensky is at the center of a lot of corruption. So, and I know, I don't want to explain how, but I do know that if you want to supply weapons to Ukraine, they like you to set up front companies in other countries and charge administrative fees and generate kickbacks, and a lot of Ukrainians have gotten very rich on this war. And I think ordinary Ukrainians are justifiably angry about that. So it's real, even if it's perhaps supported by foreign intelligence agencies.
Before wrapping up, Ambassador, here is what Donald Trump said about the latest weapons going to Ukraine.
Have made a deal with the European Union where they're going to pay the United States of America 100% of the cost of all military equipment. They're going to ship it to the European Union, and then they'll distribute it, and much of it will go to Ukraine. It's been a long time since you've heard those words, because we're in for $350 billion. But now we send it to Europe, and Europe pays, and they were great. We had a tremendous NATO meeting a few weeks ago, and it was pretty amazing, actually, what happened. They agreed to go from 2% to 5%, and they had 2% where they didn't pay. They have 5% where they've already paid. That's a big difference. That's trillions of dollars, actually, trillions. But they're going to spend that money in the United States with our defense companies, and we're going to send it to them, and they'll distribute the equipment that we send. So that's the way it should have been 3 years ago, Frank.
Very ironic, since actually in his first term, President Trump supplied the Ukrainians with a lot of weapons. Now he's treating foreign policy as a commercial transaction. The problem with this, he does not mention, and that is that the weapons have to be produced. And our own stocks are low. The Israeli stocks are low. And Israel obviously has priority over Ukraine. So It may be that the Europeans have agreed to do this. Not all Europeans have agreed, by the way. The French have not, but nor have the Spanish. I'm not sure the Italians have either. These are big powers. I'm not sure that the British are going to buy more American weapons. This undercuts the effort by Europeans like Germany to become self-sufficient, because now they're being asked to buy stuff from a big American military industrial companies. And those companies can't produce what they might want to buy. So I think this is more fiction than fact.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Happy to join you in Crete. Always fun.
Yeah.
So you have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.